Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Today is November the 6th, 2019. This just 23 days before Black Friday. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the headlines, the state of Maine's law on a la carte television. Canon is shutting down its cloud-based photo platform, Irista. Google buys Fitbit. At least 13 managed service providers are used to push ransomware. Women in STEM. Presenting IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Citrus is an American corporation that produces software designed to facilitate secure access to applications and content. At the end of day, shut down, hibernate, sleep, or just leave the PC on. Marty asked, when's the last time you had to change a bulb in a ceiling fixture? How did you reach it? The state of Maine's law on a la carte television. The cable industry is a patchwork of micro-monopolies. A natural monopoly occurs when it's so expensive to enter a market that it doesn't make sense for competitors to come in. With cable TV, there's a massive fixed cost to enter new markets, such as putting in new cable lines. Cable companies generally don't own the right-of-way, though, but have a license for it. In most arrangements, they have a franchise agreement with a local government. These cable companies obtain rights to lay their own cable and compete directly with incumbent cable companies. In effect, there are only one or two cable companies that have franchise license in designated geographic areas. The cable companies offer three services: internet, television, and telephone. When it comes to television channels, cable companies offer the basic package, which is made up of local over-the-air television channels. And they offer bundles, which includes channels with different program offerings. For most subscribers, they view only a handful of programs on selected channels, but they have to take the bundle. An example is if you want a package that includes USA, which is a respectable, if somewhat, well, unoriginal channel, then you have to get channels Chilla and Sleuth as well. I've never heard of those channels, but you have to pay for them just to get the one you want. The cost of these bundles have steadily increased in cost over the years because more and more channels that you've never heard of are stuffed into the bundle. Thankfully, cable streaming options are popping up everywhere. Many networks are doing their best to break from the bundling debacle that has dominated the TV landscape for so long. We're still in the infancy of this movement, but it's getting easier to pay for only the channels you want. While firmly established streaming services like Hulu and Netflix have helped many people cut the cable cord over the past few years, they do have limitations. Only certain shows are available on each, and usually not for hours after the broadcast debut. And they're no help when it comes to live events such as NFL or Major League Baseball games, or breaking news. This cost-cutting of television channels does not necessarily result in savings. The great irony is that cable TV companies deliver much of the broadband internet service that so many people will use to cancel their cable. They get you either way. You need the internet to stream Hulu, Netflix, and other similar offerings, but if you drop the bundle television service, the internet-only offering can easily double in cost. But now, we're closer than ever to a la carte cable, where you can subscribe to and pay for only the channels you really want and watch just about everything they broadcast in real time. Recently, Maine passed a law requiring that cable operators offer an a la carte TV option. The new law says a cable system operator shall offer subscribers the option of purchasing access to cable channels or programs on cable channels individually. This would bring an a la carte TV, which many have hoped, to the state of Maine. Now, Comcast is asking a federal judge to block this new law from taking effect. The law is already in place, but with multiple lawsuits trying to block it. Maine has said that they will hold off on enforcement until the lawsuits are resolved. This seems to not be enough for Comcast, as they now want a federal judge to get involved and ensure that the law will be blocked. The fear of cable companies is understandable. Many have predicted that a lot of cable TV channels would not survive a la carte TV, as they count on people paying for channel who don't watch the channel. The possibility of many profitable channels shutting down because most cable TV subscribers don't watch them has prevented any hope of a la carte TV in the past. This will be a major landmark case for both cord cutting and cable TV. Already, many cable TV companies and content owners have sued to try to block the law. If Comcast, Fox, CBS, Disney, and over 200 cable companies win, it will set back hopes for a la carte TV. If Maine wins, it will open the floodgates for other states to require true a la carte TV option. The law went into effect on September the 19th of this year. For now, though, it's not being enforced. Those behind this lawsuit hope to block that from happening. Comcast and other cable broadcasters say First Amendment rights to control their offering are at stake. Municipal franchise agreements for cabling rights have enabled them to be a monopoly, and this has an impact on the economics. A Maine federal judge is deciding whether to put a temporary hold on a first-in-the-nation law that requires cable companies to offer channels on an a la carte basis. A case that pits consumer choice against corporate control. A temporary restraining order is sought by Comcast Company and 9 cable broadcasters, including Disney, Fox Cable, and NBC Universal. The cable company and broadcasters sued the state and more than a dozen towns and cities in September over the new state law, which would require cable companies to allow customers to pick and pay for channels they receive on an individual basis. Cable companies generally offer channels in bundle packages, and critics say that forces consumers to pay for channels they're not interested in, watching in order to receive the channel they do want. A restraining order would formally block enforcement of the law as long as the order remains in effect. If the law is upheld, Maine would become the first state in the country to require a la carte cable selections. 10 companies have signed on and offered as friends of the court briefs in the Comcast case. Comcast said that federal rules appears to bar states and localities from imposing such restrictions on cable companies, and also said that the law would trample the cable company's First Amendment rights to editorial control over what programming it offers and how it structures cable offerings. But the state of Maine said that Comcast was trying to cloak business decisions in the Constitution. They're saying they have a First Amendment right to require that if a customer wants CNN, they also have to buy HGTV. The Maine Association of Broadcasters, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Motion Picture Association have all filed briefs in support of Comcast's challenge to the Maine law. We'll see what we'll get. Let's hope the consumer can win one. Canon is shutting down its cloud-based photo platform, iRista. Launched back in 2014, iRista served as an online solution for managing, sharing, and printing photos. In addition to the browser, iRista was also accessible via Android and iOS apps. Your first 15 gigabytes of storage was free. Canon has announced it will be shutting down its cloud-based photo storage platform, iRista, on January the 31st, 2020. You can continue to have access to your photos until the service closes, and you're asked to sign in to download them before this date. Canon says all photos and personal data will be removed from its servers on January 31, 2020. Any photos hosted on iRista can be downloaded ahead of time using the Download Your Photos link on the iRista homepage. Your photos will be compressed into a zip folder and downloaded to your computer. But Canon notes organization methods such as tags, photo ratings, titles, and albums won't be included with a download. So that information will need to be reapplied afterwards. Shared albums will still be viewable until the shutdown date, but no new users can be invited to the albums in the meantime. The iRista Photo Book service will still be in operation through the shutdown date as well. Last week, we reported on a related news item. Changes coming to Yahoo Groups. Yahoo has made the decision to no longer allow users to upload content to the Yahoo Groups site. Beginning October 28th, you were not able to upload any more content to the site, and as of December 14th, all previously posted content on the site will be permanently removed. You have until that date to save anything you've uploaded. I was advised by a listener that downloading of offloaded Yahoo group photos is one photo at a time. It took him over half a day to offload his photos from the Yahoo group. So don't wait till the last minute. There was Eastman Kodak with Gallery. There was Picasa with Google's. They were free cloud storage services that have been closed. The key operative word was free. They can be pulled out at any time. You really cannot complain. Our culture has been preached to that things should be free. But who pays for it? We humans have the tendency to value everything that we have achieved with our hard work and perseverance. This is common for us to not value things that have come to us free or unconditional. Even in an ideal world where resources are limitless, if everything were to be free and unconditional, there would be no value system to any resource and no motivation whatsoever. When the cloud-based storage is free and has built up a large base of users, someone has to pay the bill. When they can no longer continue to support it, it either is discontinued or the service is monetized. That is the real world we live in. Google buys Fitbit. For a long time, it's felt like Google has left the fate of its smartwatch and wearable platform, Wear OS, to third-party device makers like Fossil. But that's all about to change now. Google has agreed to acquire wearable giant Fitbit. In a press release, Fitbit says it was acquired for $2.1 billion. That's with a B. Meanwhile, in a separate post, Senior Vice President Rick Ostolo said Google sees this deal as an opportunity to invest even more in Wear OS, as well as to introduce made by Google wearable devices into the market. Ostolo also added that Fitbit has been a true pioneer in the industry and that by working closely with Fitbit's team of experts and bringing together the best AI, software, and hardware that they can help spur innovation in wearables and build products to benefit even more people around the world. After years of hearing rumors about a supposed Google-made Pixel Watch that never materialized, this deal should give Google the resources and expertise to create a new line of first-party wearable devices to rival other tech giants. When it comes to the wearable market as a whole, this is critically important for Google. According to IDC stats from the first quarter of 2019, Fitbit sits in fifth place for total wearable market share behind Apple, Xiaomi, Huawei, and Samsung in that order, with Apple having a commanding lead at 26%. For Google, wearables have been a missing piece to the puzzle in the company's push into ambient computing, which seeks to give users more natural and intuitive ways of accessing data or controlling devices, while preventing gadgets from being cumbersome or intrusive. Ostolo also mentioned that while Google wants to help people live healthier, more active lives, Google doesn't want to compromise people's privacy, especially as it pertains to potentially sensitive health data. So to the end, Oslo says Google will never sell personal information to anyone and that Google will always be transparent about the data that they collect. However, because Google has only just entered into a definitive agreement to buy Fitbit, I wouldn't expect to hear anything else but the virtues that Google-made wearables will have until later when the product starts coming out under the Google label. But with Google I.O. typically being held in the spring, that seems like a perfect time for Google to show off the fruits of its upcoming purchase. At least 13 managed service providers are used to push ransomware. Once hackers compromise a managed service provider, they can use the remote access tools to deploy ransomware to hundreds of companies and thousands of computers. A report published this week by threat intelligence firm Arma puts the number of managed service providers, that's called MSPs, that got hit with ransomware this year at 13 and possibly more. For those unfamiliar with the term, a managed service provider is a company that manages a customer's IT infrastructure using remote administration tools. MSPs have been around since the 90s and the dawn of large computer fleets. They've been catching on with more and more companies in recent years. By hiring an MSP, a company can cut costs by ditching classic system administrator roles and outsource all IT, that's server and desktop maintenance, to a remote team of highly trained professionals for a fraction of the cost, usually billed on a monthly subscription basis. Using an MSP typically involves installing MSP software that provides its staff with remote access to a company's resource. However, the very same software can also be its curse. This year, ransomware gangs have realized that they could compromise the network of an MSP and then use their remote access tools to deploy ransomware on their MSP customer networks, infecting hundreds of companies and thousands of computers all at once with the push of a few buttons. The trend had been noticeable to some observers. It's been reported that some of these MSP-based ransomware incidents, when they first appear back early in February, June, July, and August. In a report published this week, Arma took a deeper look at the entire MSP ecosystem and unearthed several other incidents. In total, the company found 13, but many more could be unreported. Besides MSPs, ransomware gangs have also gone after a wide variety of targets this year, focusing on the U.S. in particular. Previous Arma reports found that ransomware gangs encrypted files and crippled operations at more than 500 U.S. schools and almost 80 U.S. municipalities this year alone. Women in STEM. Challenges facing women in STEM. While men account for the majority of all STEM students, the gender gap is much smaller in fields outside of engineering and computer science. Nearly half of the students majoring in math, statistics, physics, chemistry, geology, and astronomy are women, as are approximately 60% of biology graduates. The 10 highest-paying college majors are those with a degree in STEM study. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Females in STEM study has risen to 35%. There are two young 14-year-old female students getting national attention. Elena Gassler is a 14-year-old inventor from West Grove, Pennsylvania, who came up with a clever way to eliminate the blind spot created by the thick pillars on the side of a car's windshield. Using some relatively inexpensive and readily available technology you can find at any well-stocked electronics store. She is too young to have a driver's license in most states and has never experienced the frustration of trying to see around those pillars while driving, but that didn't stop her from tackling a problem that automakers have largely ignored. Her solution involves installing an outward-facing webcam on the outside of a vehicle's windshield pillar and then projecting a live feed from that camera onto the side of that pillar. Custom 3D printed parts allowed her to perfectly align the projected image so that it seamlessly blends with that what a driver sees through the passenger window and the windshield, essentially making the pillar invisible. Her invention was part of a project called Improving Automobile Safety by Removing Blind Spots, which she presented at this year's Society for Science and the Public's Broadcom Masters Science and Engineering Competition. Her ingenuity was enough to earn her the competition's top honor, the Samuel Lee Foundation Prize, which also netted Gassler $25,000. Gassler's invention isn't quite ready to be installed in vehicles across the country just yet, but the technologies already exist that would allow it to be implemented in cars without serving as a distraction to the driver. Short-throw projectors could be installed at the base of the passenger side windshield pillar to create the image without having to worry about the passenger blocking the beam. And many cars have already replaced side mirrors with cameras, or include nearly invisible cameras in the rear for safely backing up. So adding one more on the side of the pillar would presumably be trivial. And another young lady, Kara Fan, won first place in STEAM competition. The main difference between STEM and STEAM is STEM explicitly focuses on scientific concepts. STEAM investigates the same concepts, but does this through inquiry and problem-based learning methods used in the creative process. When Kara Fan was in the fifth grade, her first LEGO Elite Robotics team won the best robot design at the Southern California competition. Her interest in STEAM continued and expanded when she got to middle school and joined numerous science fairs. This past year, her project won first place in the microbiology category of the Greater San Diego Science Fair, and Kara was also nominated for the Broadcom Master Science Competition. I am fortunate to be selected as one of the 10 finalists of the 3M Young Scientist Challenge for 2019, she said. Kara's project is called Nanoparticles in Liquid Bandage. It involves the use of copper or silver nanoparticles in liquid bandage form to kill bacteria in a minor wound. I wanted to find a different way to kill bacteria instead of using an antibiotic drug. She explained that some challenges were synthesizing the nanoparticles. I couldn't get the copper nanoparticles to kill bacteria. On the other hand, the silver nanoparticles did kill bacteria. Outside of her science adventures, Kara plays golf and the piano. Torrey Highland has been her home all life, and she loves that she can walk to school from her neighborhood. She finished at Mesa Verde Middle School, and she's now at the Westview High this fall, and a favorite school subject being, of course, science. Her volunteer experience includes food packing for people in Haiti and here at home for the San Diego Food Bank. I don't have any college plans yet, she shared, but I would like to become a doctor someday. It's great to hear that we have two 14-year-old young ladies in the field of STEM and doing well, and we hope that others will follow suit. Presenting IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Citrus is an American corporation that produces software designed to facilitate secure access to applications and content.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and this is where I take the time to put on the work hat and talk to you about those things you might hear about at the office, or maybe it's just a matter of the professional IT guy. What do you want to ask him? What do you want to know about how your network is running, how your systems run at the office? I'm here for that. Today, I'm actually going to address an email that came in, and you can reach out to me if you want to have your questions answered. I'm here for you. Just reach out to me here via the show, and yes, I will get back with you. I will address whatever IT professional questions you throw my way. In this case, Stuart reached out to me, and I would like to find out your thoughts on the Citrix Workspace application. Folks who work from home frequently must use this. Recently, there have been bugs related to Windows 10 updates and also due to two-factor authentication plugins from other vendors. Corporate help desks seem ill-prepared to handle these issues in a bring-your-own-device environment. So there's a lot of things going on in this email. It's just a few sentences, but we're talking about Citrix. We're talking about how, yes, if you're working from home, you probably are utilizing one of two things, VPN or Citrix. And I will separate out what VPN and Citrix are here in a few minutes. Then we'll talk about, yes, the bugs. And then we'll talk about the BYOD that we've actually been talking about a lot recently here in the IT professionals segment. All right. So first off, Citrix versus VPN. So let me try to unpack this as simply as I can. There are two concepts that are at work. One is called a thin client, and one is called a thick client. A thin client is a situation where there is a computer where you're at, or a terminal, and there is a computer remotely. If you go and you try to access a database, all of that database transaction information, all of the things that are happening, the computing power, the hard drive power, all of the network power is all located at the remote end. It sends a very thin stream of information from the remote computer to your computer. That thin stream of information is just the bare amount of information to put up onto the screen. So it does a lot of thinking for you. You can have something called a dumb terminal. Usually it's a dumber terminal. It's not so much of a high power computer. You can do this on pretty much the lowest end of computers. That's how companies save a lot of money. They send you out a laptop, which isn't very powerful, but they then spend more money on the back-end computers. If your laptop is stolen, no big deal. They can shut it down and lock it out of the network. No information is lost. They lose a few hundred dollars on the laptop, but then they get to spend more money on the back end, where that big database is, where the big, huge power is there. So anyways, VPN requires a more powerful laptop or remote system that's away from the computers, away from the networks. And it requires a far more robust network line, a connection to the internet, if you will. So that thick client, that means a lot of the data is going across the internet lines. Now, we can apply this thin client, thick client into a number of different areas. We do this in the offices sometimes just to put cheap computers out into shop floors or something like this. Now, Stuart calls out, yes, there have been some bugs recently in a number of different areas in regards to Citrix. This is something that was actually cleaned up, I think, a little while back. But different corporate help desks do run at different speeds, and sometimes they're very reluctant to bring on new updates. They're reluctant to address the situations, even though it fixes some of the problems that they're having. They're always afraid that it's going to introduce new problems and create an entire disaster for them. They also have to deal with something we've talked about also here on the show, which is change management, where you only are allowed to do changes under certain constraints. So that kind of slows down some of the reaction time on lesser important bugs and situations. And sometimes it's a matter of the people who are trying to fix the problem, they're not really relaying, or they're not even aware of how critical the bug is. So we go into that last item, and that is corporate help desks seem ill-prepared to handle these issues in the BYOD environment. And the reality is, yes, a lot of different companies are struggling with the BYOD. Some companies are embracing it. You want to bring in whatever it is you want to bring in. We will support, yes, your iPhone, your Android phone. We'll support your tablets. We'll support your own laptops. We'll support anything you want. Other companies lock everything down. You can only use what we say you can. And when you wind up with that situation where you're only using what they say you can, yes, you don't have the flexibility, but you do have far more reliability. I think there's always a struggle to find the right mix. I think there's always that problem that they're always trying to please as many people as they can while keeping as much control as they can. And that sometimes hurts the IT department at any company. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. At the end of day, shut down, hibernate, sleep, or just leave the PC on? Inquiring minds want to know. At the end of day, do you shut down completely? Or place the system in hibernate mode? Or place the system in sleep mode? Or just leave it on? What is Windows Hibernate mode? Hibernate mode is very similar to sleep, but instead of saving your open documents and running applications to your RAM, it saves them to your hard disk. This allows your computer to turn off entirely, which means once your computer is in hibernate mode, it uses zero power. What is Windows Sleep mode? Sleep mode, sometimes called standby or suspend mode, is a power-sparing state that a computer can enter when not in use. The computer state is maintain in RAM. When you close your memory's lid or leave it unattended for a while, it enters sleep mode. The low power mode lets you resume your system quickly, but it continues to use the battery. Over time, your battery will drain completely. You can use hibernation mode as an alternative. It saves a snapshot of the current Windows session to the hard drive so you can turn off your laptop. Here's why you may need to stop turning your computer off at night. The practice of regularly shutting your computer down and booting it back up is not without its dangers. All that work can actually stress a computer out. So what should we do to ensure the longevity of the machines that keep it running and humming along? The short answer, it depends on how often you use it. If you use your computer multiple times a day, it's best to leave it on. If you use it for a short time, say an hour or two, just once a day or even less, then turn it off. There's a difference. Leaving a computer on all the time, day and night, is stressful for your computer, but it's a constant stress. If you're not making things worse by overloading your computer with a stream of memory-munching programs, it will steadily power its way through. But if you're turning your computer on every morning or multiple times a day and expecting it to work for many hours a day over several years, that small surge of power that helps spin everything up can ultimately shorten its lifespan. But on the other hand, if you have an old machine, the risk of leaving your computer on for extended periods of time could actually outweigh those associated with turning it off and on all the time. If you've got a newer machine, it likely contains a solid-state drive that has done away with all moving parts of the traditional hard disk drive to achieve a better lifespan. The problem with traditional disk drive is that those parts wear down the more you use them, and this only gets worse when your computer heats up from constant use. Some items have a limited life cycle. For instance, if the LCD panel is left on all the time, it's only specced for about 15,000 hours, or about 2 years. For this reason, it's good to let the panel time out and turn off when not being used. The battery and hard drive also have limited life cycle, allowing them to turn off or sleep or spin down when not being used will extend the life of these components. There's still debate about the impact of shutting down and starting up today's modern components. To many, the very concept that shutdowns and startups create extra stress is dated, based on old components and mechanical parts that we no longer have in modern systems. To many, the very concept that shutdowns and startups create extra stress is dated, based on old components and mechanical parts we no longer have in modern systems. There are some solid reasons for leaving it on or turning it off that aren't up for debate. These reasons are mostly no-brainers. Leave it on if you want to use your PC at the end of the day, backing up the system. Turn it off if you want to save electricity. The occasional reboot is important, though. This generally improves the performance of your machine. On the other hand, using the sleep option is much better than letting the machine hibernate, as the latter causes similar levels of wear and tear as turning it on and off. As the latter causes similar levels of wear and tear as turning it on and off does. Me? I shut down at the end of the day to refresh the system on startup the next day. Star Trek Tri-Recorder. Star Trek, the series, was produced from September 1966 to December 1967. When given enough time, science fiction sometimes becomes science fact. The original 1960s Star Trek series took place in a universe of the future with personal communicators, holograms, and the technology to send humans beyond our solar system. In many ways, that future is here. We have smartphones, virtual reality, space travel, and now the tricorder. In the show, the tricorder was a handheld medical device that could scan a patient, read his or her vital signs, and diagnose problems in minutes. DeForest Kelly, as Dr. McCoy, used a tricorder to diagnose a patient. Imagine you have a child who wakes up Saturday morning with a cough and a high fever. You suspect it's more than a cold, but your pediatrician's office is closed until Monday. You may have a senior citizen at home who has chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, that's COPD, and seem to be more worn out than usual. Imagine if you had a tricorder that can record his vital signs and help decide whether he should go to the emergency room. If you go to the emergency room, data from the tricorder will help the doctor better understand the symptoms to decide what treatment is needed. Great advances have been made in medical equipment. The ways we collect health data have transformed over the last decade, making a real tricorder possible, reliable, and affordable. Tricorders won't replace doctors, but the more data they gather and the better the AI is able to predict and diagnose ailments, the more these devices will help individuals at home make smarter decisions about when to get care, which ultimately leads to more efficient and less expensive care overall. Such a device may very well be available today. The Butterfly IQ is available on the market. The Food and Drug Administration has approved Butterfly IQ for 13 tests. After Jonathan Rothberg's daughter was diagnosed with tuberous sclerosis, he found himself joining her on frequent trips to the doctor. MRI scans had revealed tumors and cysts on her kidneys. The experience crystallized for Rothberg, himself a doctor, how cumbersome medical imaging technology can be and what an advance it could be to make it smaller and more accessible. Diagnostic imaging technology is very expensive, hard to transport, and requires a reliable source of power. For small, under-resourced villages in the developing world, getting access to life-saving diagnostic tools like MRI, PET scans, or ultrasound is difficult. Butterfly IQ, Rothberg's company, has found an innovative way to shrink down the technology so it can be used with a mobile phone, making it a lot easier to bring these resources to remote patients. It's the winner of Fast Company's 2019 World Changing Idea Awards in the health category. Ultrasound equipment can range in price from $10,000 to $200,000 per machine, of course, depending on its complexity. Portable models are considerably less, though still relatively pricey. General Electric's V-Scan starts at $4,000 per unit, for example. Butterfly IQ ultrasound equipment costs less than $2,000, and it's portable. It's able to reduce cost so much because it's so small. Generally, ultrasound machines use quartz crystals to emanate sound waves into the body. Butterfly IQ instead uses thousands of metal drums fitted onto a chip the size of a postage stamp. It comes with a mobile app that interprets ultrasound images using artificial intelligence. Butterfly IQ is currently working with Bridge to Health to connect doctors in Kenya and Uganda with its ultrasound equipment as a diagnostic tool in remote villages. The company is also working with schools like New York University and the University of Connecticut to make sure that students have access to its device as well. Because of its ability to revolutionize both U.S. healthcare and frontline healthcare in the developing world, interest in the tech is high from a wide variety of investors. In 2018, Butterfly IQ received $250 million in funding from Fidelity, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, York Capital Management founder Jamie Dimon, and Fosun Pharma last fall. The company began shipping to more than 20,000 medical professionals who reserved devices in advance. Do a search on the following words: YouTube, Butterfly, IQ. Look at the video demo. I was very impressed by it. Hey, Scotty, beam me up. Marty asked, when's the last time you had to change a bulb in a ceiling fixture? How did you reach it? Did you stand on a chair? Did you use one of those pole things to take out the old bulb and replace it? Did you need a ladder? Well, Marty Winston will present, in Professor Irwin Corey fashion, how it's done.
Well, Superman and other superheroes can fly, so no matter what they need to get done up high when they're indoors, reaching there is no big deal and falling is not a concern. Even Inspector Gadget, go Gadget Arms, has a way to get there with his feet on something solid. That's not so much the case for you and me. It might be changing the light bulbs in a ceiling fixture, or dusting the blades on a ceiling fan, or touching up the paint, or dealing with something on or in the ceiling. You know, well, philosophically, a person's reach should exceed their grasp. In real life, it's what you can grasp that gets the job done. That's also true outdoors. When's the last time you checked or cleaned your gutters, checked your chimney, reviewed the roofing? Now, if you're a high-wire artist with extraordinary agility and a phenomenal sense of balance, you may not need to hear what I suggest, so go ahead and spend the next 10 minutes on hold for tech support. For the rest of us, our fear of heights comes to us through evolution, and we need to respect it. For us, options are a little more limited. Maybe not as limited as you believe, but limited all the same. If you're not too old, tiptoes may still be an option for things that are not too high, but I've had enough ceiling light covers drop and shatter to no longer trust tiptoes. As for standing on chairs, I've learned, again from experience, that it depends on the chair. When you sit on a chair, your distribution of weight is pretty much spread out, and the weight of your legs is pretty much supported by the floor or by the extension of a lazy boy. Now, when you stand on a chair, not a lazy boy, but a chair, the distribution of your weight is less predictable, and a disproportionate amount can focus on one leg of the chair. And depending on the construction of the chair, you may be able to take a close-up look at its bent or broken leg from your new ground-level viewpoint when it and you both topple. Depending on how high you're reaching, a step stool may be a decent alternative, good for things like the top shelves of a cupboard. A ladder would be better. The ladder you have may be perfectly okay, but I find that today's ladders have a lot of very favorable options available that relatively few people have considered. For example, a ladder with a platform level gives you much better footing than a regular rung step. Better still if there's a frame above it that you can lean on, and better again if there are features up top like hooks or shelves that can act as the extra hands that can't climb up there with you. There are ladders that fold and unfold in more than one way, and that may let them provide a broader work platform. There are ladders with extra legs that provide a significantly more stable footing on uneven surfaces. Some of them are even able to work on staircases with sets of feet on different steps. But does the work you need to do really mean that you need to climb a ladder? Sometimes, sure, there's no way around it. Other times, a stick may do the trick. Painting up there? There are paint rollers and paint brushes that fit long extension sticks or poles or whatever name they have, and they add typically 5 to 10 feet to your reach. The same for those grabbers that are useful for changing some light bulbs. There are long-reach vacuum extensions that come with or can get added to some vacuum cleaners. I've seen extensions to leaf blowers that can reach up and hook down to blow out leaves and things that are inside gutters while you're on the ground. These reach extenders are generally the least expensive options for doing what you need to get done up high. I've seen chainsaws and jaw saws and pruning clippers on long-reach poles. You get to work with your feet on the ground. But, yeah, there's a but. And it comes from classical mechanics, you know, levers and fulcrums and so on. Small changes in angle at your end of a long stick can translate into major moves at the far end. You need a really steady hand or a really forgiving task to be good with this kind of solution. Always worth considering, but sometimes needs reconsidering. Let's move on. There are alternatives to ladders. If you have a lot of extra money and a lot of extra truck-sized garage space, you could get a cherry picker, you know, one of those bucket-on-a-crane trucks. Okay, never mind. My actual new favorite is the current incarnation of an ancient structure, the scaffold. I want to talk about two of them, both from the same brand, Metaltech. One that's a great fit for what I'm doing right now, and another that I think may especially interest you. Just so we're on the same page, a scaffold is a frame that supports a platform that's always significantly bigger than any ladder's platform. The most common style, in my context and yours, is called a baker's scaffold. That's because its design is based on a baker's rack. That's a frame that lets you adjust the position and height of each shelf so it can fit anything from a pan of brownies to an oversized loaf of bread or a bundt cake. Categorically, baker's scaffolds have rungs on their narrower vertical sides and let you adjust the height of their platform. The one I got, the one that makes me grin every time I think of it, is named Scaffold Bench. It's a 4-in-1 design in that its main platform can flip over to hold one or more bench tools, like a miter saw. It has locking wheels on the legs, so it's easy to move around, and a wire storage shelf you can add. So it's a workbench and a storage shelf and more. But let's get back to scaffold basics. It can hold half a ton, several times as much weight as the most macho ladder you're likely to own. Its platform is roughly 6 feet wide and 2.5 feet deep. So there's room for you and a helper, and often all the materials you need to have up there with you. You can reach things up to about 12 feet off the floor, and when you're not using it, the individual pieces are each a couple inches thick, so it's easy to stow. So, when I'm working on pipes or wires and ceilings, even my extra high garage ceiling, wobble just isn't on the menu and everything is very close to eye level. And there's one more trick that I really love about this. My office and workspace and studio space and test bench are all in my basement, and there's a stairway up to the garage. I got an accessory to the scaffold bench that lets me swap square flat feet for its locking wheels. No tools needed for that, by the way. And that means I can put its side frames on stair steps at different levels and still work with a level platform. I intend to mount a railing and a hoist over that stairway, and this lets me work at ceiling level without wearing stunt fall padding. But for you, there's a simple fold flat 6-foot Metaltech Baker's Scaffold that Home Depot carries for under $100 plus tax. It's not as multifunctional as the scaffold bench, but it still lets you put its platform on a good working level, and it's even easier to store when you're not using it. You know, that's close to the price range of a ladder. You may want to check it out. And no, they're not paying me to say that. There's one more device that lets you feel as if you can fly. Because it can. and it can show you what it sees while it is. I'm talking about drones. They're great for patrolling gutter lines, checking out your shingles or your chimney and other such chores. If you don't own a drone and don't feel like buying one, well, maybe you have a youthful neighbor who would be happy to show you what's up there for, oh, maybe 10 bucks, give or take. So, sticks and poles and ladders and scaffolds and drones, and pretty soon, you're not so much in over your head anymore. Next time, I'll talk about ways in which a house, the house itself, can know the weather, or at least some of it, and at least some of what it or you can do about it, and why that may be worth thinking about. My forecast for you includes a 60% probability of a brainstorm.
Thank you, Marty. I have a simpler, more efficient method. I just asked my son to change the bulb and to make sure it was an LED bulb. If he's not available, I just use the chair step stool, which I use as a kitchen chair. Gee, am I missing a step? Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on amazements from YouTube, Thursday, November the 7th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, November the 8th. Their meeting time is 7 p.m. For this month, they will be meeting in a different location. They will be meeting at the Apple Store in Roosevelt Field in Garden City, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation on record and publish videos on YouTube. Thursday, November the 14th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, and check at the front desk for the room number. The Princeton PC Users Group will have a meeting on Tuesday, November the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace, located at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center in Ewing has a presentation on Windows 10 features that you may not be aware of. They meet Tuesday on December the 3rd, and the meeting time is 1:30 p.m., and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group meet Thursday, December the 12th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. We hope to see some of you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.